Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your computer and your software with and talk about apps, as a matter of fact. If you have a smartphone or a tablet, then you use apps. Do you know what they really are? You probably know what the outcome is from using them. Jesse LeGrew knows about it. He's back with us, technical team lead with the University of Wisconsin Madison's Division of Information Technology, or DOIT, focuses a lot on desktop and laptop security projects, and he'll talk about apps and answer any of your computer questions when you call in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Jesse, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Great to be here.
You know, this whole Pokemon thing, you know, Pokemon, that's an app, isn't it? Pokemon Go?
Yes, it is.
And let's right start at the beginning. What is an app?
So an application, and it definitely does feel a little bit different between different devices like Apple or Windows or Android devices. But just like any computer, an application is something that somebody creates to allow you to do some function. It could be calendaring. It could be watching movies. It could be listening to music. But it's some application that allows you to do something, interact with it to get something back, some kind of feedback.
And there are terms like app and then mobile app. Is it the same thing or is it?
When you look at kind of an application, what it is, it really is the same thing. But there might be applications that are available on standard computers, desktops, or laptops that may or may not be available on a tablet or other mobile device, or vice versa. So it just depends on kind of what you're looking at.
Would you call a website an app?
In some respects, that is a little bit of a different question. A lot of the applications that we have nowadays, they respond to us. So we give it some input, and it can change dynamically on the fly based upon what we give it. Those are normally what they call, you know, dynamic web pages, which are definitely developed by individuals that respond to input, or there are more static pages that simply display data. They may not change based upon your input or your action. However, it still does require someone or something to code the page. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of applications that will just do it for us. So we type everything in just like we might a Word document, and it'll create a web page for us. But looking at those, they don't change very much or at all. So I wouldn't normally include that as an application, but a lot of the web pages that we interact with on a daily basis, and I'd say probably 99% of them, are really applications. There's somebody behind the scenes that is actually coding or creating this environment, such as Facebook or Hulu or even Google.
And as you look at these apps, they have like quote-unquote official app stores. When I think of those, I think of Apple and I think of Google and maybe Microsoft. But there are other places, are there not, or are there?
There are other ways to get applications, especially on smartphones or mobile devices, from manufacturers that are outside. So, you know, if you're using an Android device, you might be using the Google Play Store. If you're using a Windows device, it'll be the built-in app store there, or an iOS device, the Apple App Store. One thing that a lot of people like to do, which is very common, at least with people that I work with, but they might like to root a device. Basically, what that means is it allows you to do a lot more with the device. You can interact and install applications that otherwise might not be possible. But it does have risks as far as, is it going to be supported by the manufacturer? If you do something wrong, could it completely damage and make the device unusable? And those are definite risks. But rooting devices in order to give you more flexibility in what you can do is something that's very popular, because you're really using the device not as it was intended, but you might find some benefits to it. You're going to find things that you can do that otherwise you wouldn't have to. Maybe you can find an application you normally wouldn't have to, that you would normally have to pay for. So there's reasons for doing it. However, there's a lot of risk with it. Legal risk, also risk of damaging your device. So those are concerns.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about apps. Pokemon Go, I think, was quote-unquote a free app. I had somebody showed me a few years ago Map My Run, that app, and I signed up for that, and it was free. I think I then paid a dollar later to get the upgrade, the, you know, the better version, so to speak, of it. But some apps are free, and yet they find a way to make some money off of it.
And that's even the interesting thing with looking at Pokemon Go. So some people do it through advertising. So you're going to get a pop-up every few minutes. That pop-up, whether you click or don't click on it, the person who makes the application may receive money. Now, in this case, with Pokemon Go, I've never used the application myself.
I haven't either.
But they have something called Pokecoins. So you can buy things with this money. In order to get this money that's usable in this environment, you do need to spend money. And it comes up with that risk with a lot of those kind of games where you have that immediate one-button click, which you may or may not have to confirm anything. You may or may not have to put in credit card information. It's immediate. You get a reward for it right away, but you don't necessarily understand in the background where that there's actually money flowing in between that, you know, you might find out, oh, I racked up $10,000 because of a game. And that has happened to people in the past. I don't know whether that's happened with Pokemon Go at all yet, but there are a lot of applications that has happened with. People have just spent an enormous amount of money without realizing it, or their kids have because they're using an app. Yeah. And they're like, oh, yeah, $5 for this. Okay, but the fact that you don't necessarily have to type in the information over and over again means that you could just unwittingly spend a large sum of money on a free application.
Yeah, on a free app, quote, quote, free app. And you mentioned, I kind of got at privacy a little bit. Do we need to be concerned then about privacy?
With any application that you have, especially on a smartphone or a tablet, whenever you install an app, normally you're going to get a notification of, you know, this application wants to interact with data on your phone, or it wants to use your data plan or other information. Anytime you do that, there's an inherent risk. Let's say I install some application that wants access to my contacts. Why does it really need access to my contacts? What is it going to do with that information? Who's going to have it? But people just click accept on a lot of those just out of habit. They haven't seen necessarily anything happen because of it. But your data and how it's using your device is a concern. And it could just be the concern of, well, it's going to be using battery life in the background. I'm not going to be aware of it, and my phone's going to die sooner. That might be the something you really don't notice, but, you know, if you're concerned with your data that's on your phone, your text messages, your GPS data.
Location information, yeah.
Exactly. Where you are, that's very common with Facebook. You take a picture, it might have GPS data, it's embedded within the picture. People can know where you are, what's the security risk in that, and that's just one application. When you think about all of the applications people use on a day-to-day basis, there's a lot of data out there.
Lots of data. And then there's updates.
Yep.
You know, what do you do if a device says that it needs that my apps need an update?
And for most of the updates, and I think some of the different manufacturers have made it a little bit easier, where you've always had a constant reminder, please update me, please update me. Let's say you have 50 applications. It can be quite the disturbance to continually get those messages. And a lot of times there is, at least now, there's an automatic update feature where you can allow it to install automatically. Generally, for those applications, looking at the privacy concerns, if there's a change in what data might be accessed or how your phone might be used, generally, I've seen that I've gotten a prompt. However, it's a possibility, without researching it further, that maybe that would change, it would automatically update, and you wouldn't actually know that potentially there could be some other data or application interaction that you're not aware of. But most people on their mobile devices just have a large amount of applications, one that come built into your device, but then applications that, you know, you just download on a whim. For a lot of free applications, you might be, you know, I want a stopwatch. I don't like the one that's built into my phone or my tablet. I want to download one. So, well, you might download five of them just because you're playing with different devices and you might never delete the other ones you didn't like. So you start to have a lot of clutter, and then there's a lot more updates, and it's taking more power and potentially, you know, accessing other things in your device you may not be aware of. So keeping track of all of that can be extremely difficult.
I went through and dumped some apps, and it helped my phone, actually, just to get rid of them just because I was using too many.
Yep.
And I had to go back through and say, okay, I got to delete this one. And I never use this one. I'm deleting it. And that's what I did. Well, I tell you what, we got callers online, but there are open lines for you. We get you on pretty quickly here with your software or computer question at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Duluth, Minnesota and talk to Pat. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I got a MacBook Air 13-inch screen laptop a couple weeks ago, and I'm wondering if your guest has any suggestions for a book or books that would help me understand the laptop better. I mean, in print, a book that I can,
yep.
Not something online.
Yep, understood.
Thank you.
And there are a few different resources out there. So whenever I look for books, and I've, you know, people get scared of the title, but what I call the dummy books.
Mm-hmm.
They usually explain everything really well. In this case, there is actually a MacBook for Dummies. And this was in late 2015, so it should still be pretty relevant to you learning about how the laptop works. Generally, the hardware between MacBook or MacBook Air or MacBook Pro, the devices work very similarly. They may have different components, but how to use the device on a day-to-day basis, that kind of book would actually be a good choice. Generally, you can also get these in print and or electronically if you want to. But I actually recommend the kind of the dummy series books. I've used them for a lot of different things, and they're usually really good. So that's one book available out there.
And they're always available in the bookstores.
Yep.
Pretty much every bookstore.
Yeah, and a lot of these books, even when you go to kind of used bookstores, you might find a lot of these that even if it's a year or two old, it's still going to apply a lot, and it's a mm-hmm. much lower cost. But there are a lot of books out there, usually in kind of the computer electronics section. You're going to find a lot of those. But with a quick search, I found at least a couple. But I do definitely recommend the dummy books just because they're well-written and easy to understand.
Yeah. And I like my MacBook Air. I've got one, too, Pat. So good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian in San Diego, California, up next. Hi, Brian.
How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I just want to confirm some information that I got from Google. Having downloaded a bunch of free apps, and you give a release for allowing this application to be free, and I just want to make sure that I got the information correct. And what I'm trying to find out for sure is that if I download an application and then I delete the application,
yeah,
the things that are running in the background that are taking my data, are they still running after I delete the application?
The as far as the application interaction with your data or using your device, most of those, I mean, when you delete them, it will terminate any of the processes and delete the application from your device. So I normally wouldn't be concerned with that interaction. That should be terminated as soon as you remove the application. One thing that I've done in the past, if you are concerned, let's say you delete an application and you're concerned, you know, it might be still accessing my data, it might be using my data plan, within, depending on the device, whether it's iOS, Android, Windows, they do have portions where you can see what application is basically running right now. So kind of a double check as to whether the application's running. Interestingly enough, some of those applications that give you that data are actually free applications you can download and install. So it feels like a little bit of a catch-22 there. But generally, I take a look at the resource monitoring software that's built into my device to verify it. However, I would generally believe that when I delete the application, it's not going to be doing anything with my data. It doesn't mean that the company still doesn't have any of your data while you were using the app previously.
Well, yeah, they could hang on to that.
Right. So they might not be collecting any new data from you since you removed the application. However, they may still have data that they had collected for whatever reasons while you were using it.
No. There we go.
Well, according to Google, everything associated with the application except the app, the simple application itself, still exists. That's what they told me.
Correct. You will. So the data that was collected still does exist somewhere.
No. I mean the background applications that are running with this application. Mm. This is what I'm saying. They're telling me that those applications, unless you completely wipe your phone, and those applications are still running. I mean the ones that are in the background of the application that I downloaded.
We'll ponder that for just a second to remind everybody, though, that our guest today is Jesse LeGru. Jesse is a technical team lead with the UW's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, Malik Anderson, our on-air producer. Coming up from 1 to 3 this afternoon, a panel of guests will be joining Kathleen Dunn, and they will be talking about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. That's between 1 and 3 today. Right now, we're taking a look at your computer, your software. We've talked a lot about apps with our guest today, Jesse LeGru, technical team lead with UW. Do it. Division of Information Technology. Great to have him along. And again, there's, I believe, one open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Jesse, if you have thought some more about our last caller's comment about apps running behind the scenes, even if you delete them.
And that's something that I hadn't at least seen before, or at least, I guess, never heard of. I guess it's a possibility. So there's always dependent programs that are just needed for the base system. But as of yet, so far, I don't have any additional info on it. Something I'll probably take a look at a little bit later. There might be background data that's still stored in your device. It doesn't mean it's running that you might have to clean up, and there's cache cleaner applications for Android, for example. But it's something that I had not seen, which I would actually have to research a little bit further.
Judy in Madison has a very relevant question, I think. Judy, hi. Thanks for calling. Judy, we lost Judy. She was wondering, how do you delete an app? How is an app deleted?
So for it's kind of a similar method for when you move or change your screens around. There's a couple different ways to do it. You can do it from a computer that's plugged into your device. So if you're managing your content through the iTunes application, if you're actually on the device itself, when you push on an application, you're going to see that all the little icons will wiggle. It allows you to move icons to different spaces. But there's also a little X in the upper left-hand corner of the application. You can actually hit the X key, and it will actually say, hey, by the way, you're going to delete this app, and it's going to delete any of the data for this application. All you have to do is go ahead, click delete, and it will be deleted from your device.
There you go. Bob in Clintonville has a question. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question is regard to a small website I have. I have a small sheep farm, and I had a kind of several pages of our sheep and wool and this sort of thing.
Sure.
We've had it for several years, and we got an email saying that we had malware on the thing, and I subscribed to a service, and the service expense was about $700 for 6 months, and I'm only paying $100 for the whole web hosting for a year, and I'm not really sure what they're doing. Is there a way to tell whether or not I was scammed or not?
And Normally what I would do in this kind of situation is a lot of people post great information online about scams, where they found them, and even examples of the emails that they've received. That includes company names. I would actually kind of research the company itself. It also might be something you can even find on something like Consumer Reports or the Better Business Bureau.
Yeah, what I would do in that situation, I would definitely call the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. There's an 800 number, and you know what? I don't have it off the top of my head, but I have those folks on pretty often. And what you're describing could be fine, but I know there are some scams out there that that sound very similar to what you're talking about. So if you call the Consumer Protection, Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, you can go online and find their consumer hotline number.
Sure.
And call them, and they can tell you if there are, you know, have been other complaints, or if there are, if they know for sure that this place is not right.
Okay.
I would do that right off the bat. I wouldn't waste any time.
Right.
And they may have some advice then on how to deal with your issue. We just talked about this, I don't know, maybe a week or so ago with the Trade and Consumer Protection folks, and it's well worth a quick look. Good luck, Bob. Thanks. John in Marshfield. John, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Jesse. Larry, question on the browser called Safari, which Apple supports. Are you gentlemen having any problems of using Safari and getting to different websites? In that we don't support Safari, they come across and they won't let you in. Also, Google is coming on my software, which is Mac OS X 10.8, saying we don't support you anymore. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and for the every now and again, there are different websites that will have support for different browsers, including the operating systems that they run on. Generally, for just looking at macOS in general, they have a support where they normally support the last three operating systems, which in this case would be 10.11, 10.10, and 10.9. In that case, that would mean that 10.8 is no longer supported, meaning that you wouldn't receive security updates. You may not receive updates for applications such as Safari, and most likely it's due to that why you may or may not be able to access certain sites, or why there might be kind of support concerns. And the one thing I'd recommend, one would be to kind of update to a later version, whether it's 10.9, 10.10, or 10.11. But also, you can even use third-party browsers. You can still get a fully updated Firefox, Google Chrome, and there's a lot of other options out there.
I have all three. I have the three that you mentioned.
Yep, and you can install those. You can get the latest versions. Just due to Apple support, if 10.8 is not supported, it's possible that even Mozilla will not release Firefox for that version of your operating system. So that's still a possibility. Mm-hmm. But you might be able to get a more recent version of a browser from one of these other open source companies that allow you to install it for free.
Yep.
Yeah, see.
All right.
What happens if the equipment's too old?
If the equipment is too old, unfortunately, there's not much of an option to upgrade to a new version of the operating system. They do have basically tight holds on what hardware is supported. But the other options of different browsers should be a good option. I think that you're most likely going to be able to find a way to install the latest version of Google Chrome. I haven't tried it recently on anything prior to 10.9, but I think there's going to be a very good chance that you're going to be able to download Firefox, Google Chrome, or a different browser that's going to give you the capabilities to view those websites.
Yep.
Well, I've been forced to go to Firefox because of the equipment being 10 years old.
Yeah, that's getting up there, and so you definitely want to take a look at those other options for sure. Good luck. Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate your call. Judy in Madison up next with a question. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. I got disconnected a little while ago, so I didn't My question was about deleting the app, so I didn't get to hear that. But my second question is, if you double-click on the home page on Macs, you find out what's running in the background. Does that take up energy? Should I be double-clicking and getting rid of those before I close it down, or doesn't it really matter?
And kind of a refresher on the deleting the application, too. So the same way you can move applications around on your home screen, when you push on one of those with your finger for a few seconds, it starts to wiggle. You'll see an X in the upper left-hand corner. That X will allow you to delete the application. You'll get a confirmation about it. That's just a refresher on that one. And for the other applications, when you're looking at utilization, whether you should run them in the background or not, it kind of depends. There's some usefulness of having those applications running in the background when you do want to access data right away, such as email or something else. Generally, I leave mine pretty much running all the time, and I generally don't quit any of those applications. One thing I do to try and free things up is I might just restart my phone once a week or once every month, so it kind of starts off from scratch, and a lot of those may not be taking a lot of that utilization in the background. But I do look, if I have had data concerns or my battery's running low, I do take a look at the general settings for my device and take a look at the applications and if they're allowed to access, for example, data from my data plan or Wi-Fi or both. Because you might get some performance increases or you might get some battery savings if you're only using Wi-Fi instead of the data. So there's a lot of other things to balance there, but generally I don't, unless I really don't need any of the information from it, but I might just restart my device every so often.
Yeah, I kind of do the same thing, and frankly, with my MacBook Air or any of my devices, if they're acting a little hinky, I restart them. And often, probably 9 times out of 10, that's all I needed to do. So there you go, Judy. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Bill in La Crosse next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. My question is how do you delete browser history?
And that's it's a great question. There's a few different ways to do it. Part of it really does depend on the browser that you're using. What browser are you using in this case?
Google.
Okay. So Chrome is something.
Chrome.
Yep. And that's an application I've used in the past, too. There are a few ways to do it. If you go to the Chrome icon, and this depends whether it's macOS or Windows. It's generally going to be a preferences option, or it's going to be on the Mac. You'll actually see Chrome in the upper left-hand corner, and you can click on it.
Windows 10.
Okay. And without seeing it right in front of me at the moment, it's probably on the file menu, but they have an option for clearing browser data. And you can just click on that, and it's going to tell you, I'm going to clear all of your browsing history or download history. This is also available from the settings pane. So when you go to, in this case, I'm looking on a macOS computer, so it's a little bit different. But if you go to your preferences, this is where you can set your home page. And a lot of other data. It does have an option for security and to clear data. And so it can clear your bookmarks, it can clear your caching data, it'll clear your browsing history, and it will actually allow you to select each individual option. You just hit clear, and it'll remove that.
Okay, that sounds good. So suppose I had some also on Yahoo. Is there a way there similar?
It would be similar. And I'm trying to think of, when you say Yahoo, can you give more of a description?
Well, I use the Yahoo Finance, but once in a while I go to their homepage, and if I happen to already be there, I might just go to their homepage and browse from that.
Okay. And when you do, so in this case, when you actually use the options that I've outlined, it should remove that data as well.
Okay, I'll try that.
All right, give it a shot, Bill. Thanks a lot for calling. Here's Ann from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering what options there are for accessing data and using my smartphone when traveling overseas, and this would be in both Morocco, and then France and Spain. My smartphone isn't compatible for an international calling plan, so my phone provider told me that it would only work where there's Wi-Fi access overseas. And some of the options they talked about was buying a throwaway phone from an airport kiosk, but that may not both work in both North Africa and Europe, or installing a messaging app on my phone called WhatsApp, or using Skype when I had Wi-Fi, or buying a tablet, which they were really pushing because they're having a tablet special.
Yeah, and actually...
No kidding.
A lot of those solutions are actually good ones. It really depends, you know, whether you want to kind of invest money or what the capabilities are at the location. Some people might also be concerned with security, especially when you're traveling overseas and any kind of security in that regard. But I think that Skype and a lot of those options, so if you don't have actual cell phone service but you need to communicate, using those applications is going to be a really good solution. Even if you do have other iPhone users that you're communicating with, the messaging app that's built into the iPhone can be used specifically over wireless instead of actually being able to have a cellular signal.
And my phone is a Samsung.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And for the Samsung, it's similar. So the nice thing with Skype and a lot of those applications, they are cross-platform. They build it for Android, iOS, and the Samsung phone should work well with Skype. I've used it in the past myself. And the other messaging options, there's, once again, unfortunately, there's a plethora of them. So yeah. It depends on who you're communicating with, what they use, what you use. But there's a lot of free applications out there that'll do it if you do not have a data plan. And Skype is a great option because it is free. A lot of people have been using it for quite some time, and it allows you to, in some ways, you can even have a phone number attached to it, so somebody can actually call you and you can receive a phone call while you're connected to wireless. There might be an additional fee for that, and I believe there is, but it's an option where somebody can actually call you to your Skype number.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Carol in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a thing that's been happening with Outlook emails that has been bugging me a bunch. A lot of times I have a rule that I make for things like bills that come in, and I want them to go to the bills folder so that they're not just lost in the great flood of regular emails. And sometimes I'll make a rule, and it doesn't work the next time. And I had something come in today, and it did not go where it was supposed to go. So I made a rule, and then I thought, what's going on here? And I looked at my rules, and that one had a 7 after it. And when I looked, there's a total of 8 versions of that rule in there already. And there's the words that are being attached to every rule that you make that say, and stop processing further rules. And I don't know if you've ever had this kind of thing happen, because whatever they intended with that and stop processing ever rules, what it does is make your rule never happen again. So yeah. It's not a rule after all. And
all right, well,
I went hunting. I did find the solution. But it'll just drive you nuts because it happens automatically, like it or not, and you have to go fix every single one of those independently. And what you do is you go into manage your rules, you highlight the rule that has that problem on it, and then you hit next, and the next list that comes up has the box that you can uncheck that has that stop processing further rules. And then you have to go and do every one of them. I had like 100 of them that I had to go through, and I thought, whatever. But somebody changed something on one of those updates, and now that happens automatically. Every time you make a rule, you're going to have to go fix it, or the rule won't do any good the next time you need it to act.
Jesse?
Yeah, and that, so there's, rules can actually be extremely tricky depending on how you create them. Normally, so let's say you do have a bill and you want it to go into, let's say you want it a copy filtered into multiple folders. In that case, generally, that's when you'd uncheck that box to not process any rules below it, because most people just want something to go to one place. in this case, you know, when you look at a rule and you're creating it for a company that might be sending you a bill, the biggest question is, what do I make that rule off of? Do I make it off the subject? Do I make it off of the body of the message? Do I make it off of who's sending it to me? There is no one right answer because everyone generates emails differently. They might use randomly generated from addresses, or they might completely change their subjects. So there's a few tricks you can do in creating rules, but it always depends on kind of what the prior information you have is and what those emails look like to make good rules. Unfortunately, there's not one silver bullet, but those are some of the things I look at when I create rules.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Carol. Appreciate your call. And John in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Before I get to my question, there was one thing I was going to offer with respect to folks wondering about deleting apps and not having them run background use data. And there's a need to understand between deleting and uninstalling. Different manufacturers of phones, for example, that I've had on the Android system, you know, if you hit the screen to get all of your icons wiggling and just hit the X, sometimes you get, or hold one down, sometimes you get the delete option up top to drag, and you do not get a or an uninstall option, and some you do. So just food for thought for some of those folks.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and then my question is, may or may not have heard of people having issues once they had Windows 10. Something on. I say that tongue-in-cheek. So in addition to a number of my drivers not being now compatible, it seems that my Norton Antivirus 360 is using up anywhere of 98 to 100% of the CPU sometimes. And I tried to look through settings on that and such. And I guess, number one, if you have experience, that could be affecting that. And then number two, if any ideas and suggestions to look at it.
Yeah, normally when I have... so any kind of product can have high CPU usage. In case of, I guess in this case for Norton 360, I'd probably be looking for any kind of patch that might help to resolve it. Many times these could be widespread issues. In this case, maybe it's specifically with Windows 10, and I would look to see if there is any application updates that you might be able to install. And it does, just taking a quick look, a lot of people has kind of reported this as well, and some specific to Windows 10. So normally I'd look for the latest update that you have, but let's assume that Norton 360 is just not going to work for you. The built-in Windows Defender and other malware technologies from Windows, they've gotten better over the ages and might actually be a pretty good substitute right now. Normally, Norton or any antivirus program will kind of disable that built-in feature just because you don't want to have two running at the same time because it's going to impact your computer. But I would actually look for it. I would just double-check there's not a Norton 360 upgrade. That would fix the issue. Otherwise, you can even depend on the built-in application that's within Windows. A lot of people have had great luck with it, especially just due to how it's evolved over the years and the antivirus technologies that Microsoft is creating as well. But, you know, there is no one antivirus product that's 100% effective. So it's possible that the built-in Windows technologies may be better in some cases than Norton or vice versa.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. I've had a lot of people say good things about the Windows antivirus, the latest anyway. Jesse LeGru, our guest today, technical team lead with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Jesse LeGru of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology, talking about your software, your computer, your apps with him. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And Larry from Muscadet emailed to say he's worried about security and asked, wants to ask, what makes a public Wi-Fi hotspot more inherently dangerous than the Internet in general? And what do everyday users need to do for reasonable identity security using our devices when out and about?
And the difference in security, there's a few different reasons. One, wireless versus even just being plugged into a normal network. Generally, when you go to any open or free Wi-Fi, usually it's not secured, which means your data is not encrypted, unless you're using other secure applications on your actual computer itself. So there's an inherent risk of people being able to just collect your data on the Wi-Fi, even if it's not the people who are giving you that wireless. However, it's possible they're collecting your data as well. One thing that I always recommend is to use a virtual private network application. They also just call it VPN. You can get a lot of different VPN applications out there. You may have one through work, or you might be able to purchase a subscription, and there might be ones out there for free as well. But it'll allow you to encrypt all of your traffic. So even if the Wi-Fi isn't protected, it allows no one to snoop in on the data that you're transmitting between your computer and the Internet in general. The Internet in general, is it dangerous? Sure, it is. But it always depends on, you know, what you're doing, what you're browsing. If you go to a website and you see HTTPS, it's at least more secure. It's not going through in what they call clear text, so people can just read it easily. They have to kind of break into your data. And there's a lot of different versions of SSL, which makes that secure web traffic work, and some are more secure than others. So it always depends on what application you're using, how you're navigating the Internet. There are inherent risks. VPNs do help a lot, but also just to make sure that you do have other safety measures on your computer, whether it's antivirus or a lot of other applications that will actually take a look at your network traffic and say, you know, this is going to a bad place. I'm not going to allow it. So there's other safety measures you can install as well.
Steve in Grand Marsh has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
You're one of the gems of NPR. I love having you.
Thank you.
My question regards cell phones and SIM cards and being able to switch them around. I currently have U.S. Cellular, which, to my knowledge, uses a CDMA network. Okay. My question is, I'm looking at a new phone and via Samsung. I can buy the exact same model that U.S. Cellular sells me, but buy it directly from Samsung. Can I just pull my SIM card out of my current U.S. Cellular Samsung phone and make it work, or what do I have to go through?
So that is a great question, one of which I'm actually not sure of the exact answer. So normally you can move phones or SIM cards from one phone to another to easily get connectivity to whatever you're doing. So if I have two iPhones, I can, and the battery's dead in one, I can move that SIM card, move it into another phone. It'll identify with my own plan, my phone number, and I'll be able to use calls, receive calls, and all that good stuff. In this case, it depends on, one, if the phone does have a SIM card and it's compatible. In theory, you should be able to plug it in and it should connect. But I would normally, in this case, I would probably have to look actually at the phone itself to just verify the capabilities. I haven't actually swapped SIM cards for U.S. Cellular. Sometimes there are complications depending on exactly the plan you have and the phone that you're swapping it into. Generally, I would say it should work, but I wouldn't be completely certain until I knew exactly kind of what you're moving to, what you're moving from, the details of the plan. And, you know, I'm unfamiliar generally with the CDMA and the move from U.S. Cellular phones.
Hmm. There we go. Thanks a lot, Steve, for calling. So, you know, you go to the place where you're going to get the phone, I suppose, and you can even try it out. Wouldn't you be able to?
In theory, if you have the phone if you're able to go somewhere and plug in your SIM card, you should be able to test it right away and find out if it's going to work. I'm guessing that no one would have a concern if you did try it. I think it just depends on, it probably has changed from company to company, but
yeah,
if you can just find a phone in a store and plug in your SIM card, you're going to find out pretty quick. But even taking a look, there are some different phones that just don't have the appropriate SIM card because they have micro SIM or normal SIM, and it might change between LTE and CDMA. So there's complications in there I don't fully, at least I've not fully embarked on myself.
Somebody wonders, what is a SIM card?
Yeah, and a SIM card, and what it is it stores, it pretty much identifies your, in your case, or in everyone's case, your phone number and your phone plan. So it might actually store contacts on your phone. It depends on your phone model. But it really identifies your identity with the phone carrier. So when you put a SIM card into another phone, that phone turns on. It's like, okay, I'm using Sprint. I have this phone number. And I also might have these contacts. So some of the SIM cards will store some data, so you can even more easily move between devices.
Jill in Altoona up next. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a question. I have an iPhone, and every time I delete my emails, and then put them in, you know, usually now I put them in trash and then delete them, but they still keep coming back. So it gets to be really annoying. And the other one is, I always get two notifications per text messages, and I really only need one, and I don't understand why I'm getting them.
Hmm.
For the first thing with the email,
yes.
Do you use another device to check your emails as well, or mainly just your iPhone?
They can come up on my desktop, because I've got them set up that way, but I don't normally check them there.
Okay. I was curious if you had seen the same behavior with emails on your, you know, normal computer that you have with your iPhone.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think once I delete them there, they're gone.
Okay.
But it doesn't seem to matter if I put them in junk or not. You know, like if I mark them as junk, they just keep coming.
Okay. Do you know what kind of email or how it's configured on your phone?
It's the standard email app that comes with the iPhone.
Okay. Do you happen, and there's, so there's kind of a few different ways to access email on an iPhone, or any device, really. They have something called, you know, if you're using Gmail, for example, it's kind of got its own built-in thing, or it has something like Exchange, IMAP, or POP. And do any of those sound familiar?
Can you say that again? Which ones?
Generally, they say Gmail, Exchange, or Office 365, or POP or IMAP.
IMAP.
No.
So the and you can check the settings when you go to your to General and your email settings. You can check the various items. Normally, if you're seeing that kind of behavior, it does make me think you might be using something like POP email. So POP generally will download. It may not filter into folders the way that other email applications will, and it might work differently on an iPhone. So I would check that just to see. My preference would be IMAP because it will keep a maintained folder structure and it will look the same generally on your computer that it will on your phone. But I'd also take a look at your computer too just to see if you do see a difference. Another thing that I'd recommend is to see if you do have any email filters. Maybe there's an email filter that's kind of bouncing emails around that's causing it to go from the trash or go somewhere else and causing that behavior. That could be another possibility.
Okay, that could be it.
Another thing I'd actually consider too, sometimes the information on your phone, I've had sometimes my iPhone just gets a little weird. It's not updating my calendar right or it's not updating my email correctly. I might just delete the account from my phone and add it again. It'll rebuild all the settings, download all the email from scratch. But before doing that, too, you know, the biggest question is, hey, where is my email? Is it on my device or is it actually with my email provider? So before doing any of those kind of deletions, I always want to make sure, hey, can I access my email from another device? Is everything the way it should be before I potentially delete data?
Right.
Okay,
that sounds good. And then as far as text coming twice, any idea?
One idea that I might have is something they call iMessage. iMessage is something that's built into the iPhone, so when you actually communicate with other iPhones, I've had weird things happen with that when I've either changed from an Android to an iPhone or I'm communicating with somebody else that switches from an Android to an iPhone, that could be part of it, is that iMessage and it creating duplicates.
Actually, I'm sorry, it's not doing duplicates, it's doing double notifications. So I always get two. It'll beep at me once, and then a minute later it does it again.
And actually that is, does it only beep twice when you haven't actually opened the message? That is, by default, their setting. So if you actually leave a message and you don't touch it and you leave your phone alone, it just beeps you again to remind you, hey, you know, you should really check that text okay. message. But I would actually take off, you can actually turn that off. So if you go into your messages, it does have an option for what they call repeat alerts. My guess is your repeat alerts is set to once, set it to never, and you will not have to worry about that anymore.
That helps so much, because I go around inside all those settings, but there's so many of them. It's hard to find them.
Yep.
All right, I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And I think Rex may have a quick question in Bayfield. Rex, you got a quick question?
Yes. Just a second. I'm putting a dead. I was wondering if your guest about the good idea for Microsoft on security, do that on 7, or will that only, development only follow in Windows?
All right, so will Windows 7 keep up with Microsoft updates?
Yeah, and at least, and I just pulled up, they basically have, just like any company, Apple's very similar, they have kind of a support timeline. How long do they support an operating system? We know that Windows XP, for example, they got rid of support in 2014. So you don't get security updates or any of the stuff you need. 7, you will have it till 2020. If you want them later, upgrade to 8 or 10.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Jesse LeGru, our guest, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. Today, and it's great to have him along with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We'll be back right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Talking about computers today on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Jesse LeGru, technical team lead with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. All our lines are filled, but there's a keep trying at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Peter in Bayview has a question next. Let's go there. Peter, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I want to follow up on that fellow who was asking about browsers and deletion of information earlier. And I have two email accounts, one with Yahoo and one with Google, about 15 years now or so. But however, I foresee an urgent issue that I will have to deal with. I think I'm turning into an old guy at 79 years of age, and I could drop dead or die for whatever reason. And what happened? So two questions, therefore, with my email addresses or accounts, I guess they would be. How do I notify or have some or arrange to have someone else notify Google and Yahoo that I am dead, number one? And what happens if I die and nobody contacts Google and Yahoo? Does all my data stay active forever and ever and ever? So that's my questions. I'll just listen.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter.
So I'll tackle the second question first, which is what happens to your data if you, let's say you don't access it. So this is going to be different depending on the company. So for example, Yahoo, I've had a Yahoo account for quite some time, but I didn't log into it for a long time. So I'm not using it. I might be receiving email, but I'm not accessing it. In those cases, generally, they're going to disable and eventually delete your account and delete all your data. So that might be different once again, but beyond or for different email carriers, but that's generally what's probably going to happen. They're going to disable it. They're going to delete it because you haven't used it. That's usually in the end user license agreement. So you can even review the informational EULAs for Gmail, for Yahoo, and it'll probably state it right in there. Now, what to do about your email account or to get notified or have somebody else notified when you pass away. So I would actually say a lawyer's a good option in this case. There are a lot of services that will allow you to plan for this eventuality, to actually have people notified in this event, and there are actual processes from Gmail, Outlook.com, in this case Microsoft, on how to get access to somebody else's account if they are deceased. And there's a, it still involves lawyers and a lot of other things. But I would actually say contact a lawyer. There are online services that actually do assist specifically with this kind of thing, your digital resources and what to do after you die.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. It's one I hadn't thought about before. Jim in Iron County, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Larry. I have a question about battery life on a Samsung Galaxy S5 Android phone. To give you a concrete example, the phone was charged at about 100% this morning around 8 o'clock, and now it's down to 38%. I bought a new battery thinking that might resolve the problem, but it really has not. So I'm wondering why it is that my battery life seems to be so short relative to when I bought the phone about a year and a half ago. And secondly, whether or not one should wait until the battery is almost fully discharged on this device or any device before plugging it in to have it recharge.
Okay.
And I'll tackle this one three reverse order as well. So as far as letting your battery drain, most people, at least quite some time ago, there was a concern with battery memory. So it would remember how much it was charged, not allowing it to discharge fully affected the life of your battery. I think that's generally still the case now, but actually allowing your phone to completely die might have a few other benefits. It might actually help to recalibrate the battery depending on the device that you're using. That's something that Apple recommends for some of their devices, and I think it might even be similar for Samsung or other mobile devices. So allow it to completely drain and then plug it back in and allow it to power back up. One other thing as far as, you know, so that might actually, maybe it'll fix the issue. I have a feeling it may or may not in this case. There was actually a post about the Galaxy S5 and an update that came up in around late January that actually did affect battery life. And to actually take a look at some of the applications that are actually taking up the power for your battery. And they do have that within different applications you can purchase, or you can actually see the utilization directly within the settings of your Android. But they actually do have a process to boot your Galaxy S5 in a safe mode, and then to allow it to recalibrate and power the phone back on. And that's something specifically for the Galaxy S5 with that update. It may or may not help in your case, but I would actually take a look at the utilization of power for all the various applications, see what applications you have running, and potentially even start disabling some of the apps you know don't need to be run in the background. That should at least help, but if it was something that just recently very quickly happened, I would consider, you know, did I install an application in the last month? Is there a different change that I should be aware of? It could even be an application update that made it happen, or it could be the battery itself. So that's always a possibility that the actual hardware might be having an issue, but I would actually allow it to fully discharge, fully power it on, and then take a look at the apps that are running, disable what you don't need, but also look to see if you do need to, you know, restart your phone in safe mode to help recalibrate the battery. And you can find that if you actually just look for Galaxy S5 battery life issues, you'll most likely find that in the first post or two and how to go through that procedure.
Okay, very good. The battery has been replaced within the last month. That didn't have any effect. And I have very frequently let the phone discharge all the way to be zero charge, and so that hasn't affected. It's really been a kind of a gradual progression over time. Hmm. So it must be a hardware issue.
All right.
Yeah, and I think in this case, it could be hardware, but I actually have a feeling it is software.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Because it's most, especially since you replaced the battery, mm-hmm. most likely there is software that's really just chewing up battery life. And one of the recommendations that they have, so they have wonderful names for their Android operating systems. In this case, they say, you know, downgrade to Android 4.4 KitKat, and that might actually resolve your issue. So the software update itself caused the problem, not the hardware. So I would actually look for that. that most likely you upgraded to Android 5.5. That's when the battery issue started happening, and actually downgrading might resolve the issue. I'm guessing in the future they might have a new update that fixes it, but I have a feeling in this case, since you did replace the battery, it's probably a software issue.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. We were talking about charging batteries off air, and there's with phones, and I learned a little trick. I couldn't get my phone to charge properly, and I was talking to a friend, and he said, well, you know, he got a toothpick and cleaned out the charging area because I just throw it in my pocket, and there gets lint in there. And you take a paperclip or whatever and clean that out, and voila, it worked again.
Yep, it does work wonders.
It works wonders for sure. Laura and Baraboo, thanks for calling.
Hi, I have the same phone that the previous caller, and the recent Samsung update that came through changed a lot of things on my phone. The biggest issue I'm having with it is that when I attach a photo to an email, it's like it's too big to go. It won't go. And I've got my photo settings. It's the native application that came with the phone. And I've got the smallest photo size chosen, and I can be sitting 5 feet away from my Wi-Fi, and it will not go. So I'm getting pretty frustrated with that.
And what kind of emailer are you using? Is it Gmail?
I'm using a program called, what is it even called? I use Gmail, I use Outlook, and I've got it all combined on my phone. And I'm on my phone, so I can't even look at it right now. Do you think that might be the problem, the actual software I'm using instead of just using Gmail directly?
It honestly could be either. So generally, there's a few things when sending pictures. So if you haven't had issues in the past, I would generally not think it's your email provider, unless they've really changed something recently that you weren't notified about. A lot of email providers will have a limit. You can only send an attachment this size. In this case, if you were able to do it before, I wouldn't be concerned. I would actually look at the application that you're using.
It's MailWise.
Okay. I would actually look at an application setting within that email.
Okay.
So the application itself might have a setting, only allow attachments of this size. That might be where you could have the limitation issue.
Okay. Oh, good. I'll look for that. I hate to take good pictures and then not be able to
share them. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. A writer posted on Facebook to ask how he can get his Mac auto spell check to stop messing with his passwords.
Oh. That's a great question. So it kind of depends in this case where you're typing in your password. Most of the time, let's say on a website, it's going to know that a username is a certain field. It's going to know that a certain password is a certain field. Usually it will not auto-correct passwords because it knows that this is a password field. It's going to have weird stuff in it, and I'm just going to completely ignore it. So I'd probably be more concerned of the fact that that is functioning on your password fields, because it almost makes me believe that you might be using an application that isn't flagging that information the proper way for the operating system to say, you know, you can ignore this, you're going to obscure the information, you're not going to auto-correct. Because otherwise, it really does depend on what application you're using that's happening on, because normally I don't have that happen myself.
Yeah. Mark in Madison, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Great, I have an iPhone 6, and it's the same problem I had, I think, with my iPhone 5. I've had this happen, like, probably 10 times, where I'll go in to a contact, and my contacts are all linked to Gmail. So I'll edit a contact, like delete a phone number. Let's say somebody has 3 phone numbers, and one of them is an old phone number. And I'll delete the phone number, and what happens is the entire contact gets deleted. It's gone. And I have to recreate it. And I only deleted the one line of the phone number. I didn't delete the contact. And there's 2 phone numbers remaining, and they're all gone. Have you ever seen that?
I don't know if I've had that issue recently. So I have used Gmail in the past with not only an iPhone, but also just an iOS device. So using the native contacts application that's in there. Over kind of the years in using different Android, iOS, and other devices, I've actually gotten used to simply going to Gmail and modifying my contacts directly from there instead of using a third-party device, because it seemed to give me the most consistent results. But I've had the issue where I've had multiple contacts because I have three different devices synchronizing things that look a little bit different, or they think they look a little bit different. I just modify it directly on the storage source itself. I go right to Gmail, I modify it there, and at least when I've done that in the past, it seemed to help.
Yeah, I haven't had that problem when I go to Gmail on the web or anything. I just when I'm on the phone and literally the whole contact goes away.
Yeah.
The whole name and everything. And I just wondered if there's some trick or something to prevent that. But maybe it's just the way it interacts.
Yeah, and it could be the interaction. It could be sometimes the local cache of the device will get a little outdated and maybe not display properly. Even just, you know, kind of removing, changing, kind of resetting your phone in a way to its original synchronization settings, adding the account back and letting it to resynchronize might solve it as well. Because there could be some conflicting sync sources, so that might be an option as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Gary and Mellon up next. Hi, Gary.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I've got an old Samsung phone, and I'd like to go up to, like, an iPhone or something like that. I'm not real tech savvy, but something that with the old phone I have, I could never get on the Internet.
Yep, so you want a new smartphone and wondering what might be best for you.
Correct.
And it depends on how you want to use your phone on a daily basis as far as usability or the simplicity of use. I think a lot of people really do like the iPhone. It's very easy. You pretty much point for whatever you want, and you get there. And you know what you're going to get, even if you get a new iPhone in 2 to 3 years. Generally, it's going to be very similar. It keeps up with upgrades, and you get a consistent experience. Androids can be a little bit more difficult just because depending on the actual model of the phone and the carrier that you have, whether it's Sprint, US Cellular, or any of the others, each phone might be a little bit different because they have their own applications. They might have their own backgrounds. You might not know what you're going to get just because they have their own kind of software suite on it. The iPhone is consistent, easy to use, and it's widely used by a lot of people.
Which model or whatever would you suggest?
The biggest difference between the iPhones right now is really size. So when you look at the different phones, I think the biggest question is, you know, how much space do I need? If you don't have a smartphone right now and you don't have a lot of data you want to store on it, you know, the lowest storage setting might be the way to go. Because you're also going to save money if you go for lower storage. The second question is going to be the size of the phone. So, for example, they have the Plus version, which is pretty large. It's very easy to read. But it's just large. So is it going to be comfortable when you put it in your pocket? Are you going to have a case for it? So some of those are going to be the usability items and the comfort level that you have for the device.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not looking for a real large one. I just carry it in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're just looking to upgrade even just to a smartphone, you might be able to get a used smartphone. You might be able to get a used iPhone that's going to save you money. It might be a little bit smaller. Right? And it'll work fine. If you've never used a smartphone before, pretty much any smartphone is going to give you more than what you had in the past. So I would actually look to see if you can get used iPhones. There are a lot of different vendors out there that will resell devices for recycling programs, and that might be a really good option.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I was just thinking about my phone usage, and it's probably, I haven't done an actual percentage, but it must be 90% is non-phone use. It's online, it's texting, but basically, it gets used in a lot of different ways. Jim in Saukville, hello.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So you had a caller with a Samsung Galaxy S5 and a problem with the battery draining as it ages.
Yeah.
And I had the same issue until my U.S. Cellular store pointed the way to fix all that. So to the left of the button at the bottom of the phone in the blank space, if you tap that, you'll see a pop-up where you can close all running apps. If you make a habit of doing that several times a day, you're not having apps running for nothing. In my case, I had, you know, tons and tons and tons and tons of apps running, and they just would restart a new one, and I ran out of memory and was running out of battery. So it's a very simple process. You just tap to the left of the button in the bottom center. There'll be a window that pops up. You click close all, and you're not using all the battery. So even my old Galaxy S5, which I don't really use, the battery lasts because I keep the apps closed.
Very good. Boy, I'm glad you called, Jim. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's a nice thing about the show. There's always people that call in with good suggestions and interesting questions. Kim in Menominee County, Michigan, it's your turn next. Hi. Oh, I'm sorry. Richard in Spencerport, New York. Instead, it's your turn.
Hi. Thanks for getting me on. On Windows 10, when I highlight an area of a page and then try to print that just highlighted area, it prints the whole page out. I used to be able to do that in Windows 7. And I've Googled it, and everybody seems to be having the same problem. And I have a new computer, too. And I've tried on my old computer and new computer, and just can't seem to print the selected areas out on the page.
What program are you using that has a text on it? Is it Word? Is it Notepad?
Well, I'm saying, say like a Yahoo Mail.
Okay.
Or just an article in the news.
Okay, so you're using you're basically trying to print from a web browser, correct?
Right.
Okay. And are you using the built-in, it's not Internet Explorer anymore, but are you using the built-in web browser that they have on Windows 10?
Right, I'm using Mozilla.
Okay.
And then even when I was with Explorer, well, I don't know if I had Windows 10 then, but anyway.
All right.
So in this case, it kind of depends on a few different factors. It does sound like it's a kind of a web browser specific issue. I haven't personally had the problem myself, but I also haven't actually tried it. If you do have issues at certain sites when printing selection, I would just try a different browser to see if you do get a different behavior. But if it is happening with every browser, it actually might be the website itself. If they did change the way that some of the website functions, it will print either a little differently than you're expecting, or it may not kind of live up to the setting of printing highlighted selections.
So there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, here we are out of time, and I'm so sorry that we didn't get to everybody. We've got a number of posts yet and so forth, but kind of that's the way it always works around here, Jesse. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Look forward to your next visit.
So am I. Thank you.
Jesse LeGru, Technical Team Lead with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. It's always great to have him with us, and he'll be back, and we'll talk with him again. Coming up at from 1 to 3, remember, Kathleen Dunn will be talking about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Tomorrow we'll be talking astronomy at 11, of the Juno probe that just reached Jupiter, among other things. So stay with us for that, and stay with us right now. Lots more in store.